All right, we're going to get this conference committee started. This is the Friday, May 8th, 2015 meeting of the Transportation Public Safety Finance Conference Committee, House File 4. Members and members of the public, we are going to take up a discussion and hopefully an action on one item, a discussion on three items, action on one of those. We're going to hear a little bit about the trunk highway bonding proposals in our respective bills, and also hear from subject matter experts about how trunk highway bonding programs interact with the state's overall debt picture and our ability, how it impacts our ability to support the size of a general obligation potential GO bonding bill. Because there's always a lot of questions about that. And maybe also, I don't know, I haven't warned MnDOT about this, but understand a little bit about the 20% threshold that we have within the Trunk Highway Fund. Oh, they were warned. The actual brains of the operation has been in communications. We're going to hear about the deceased volunteer firefighters' death benefits matter, and Senator Jensen has been our lead on that and has worked out kind of a final, some final language, and we'll make a proposal in that regard to the conference committee. And then we'll hear a little bit about, and maybe council can help us step, at least on our side, to help step us through our public-private partnership proposal. And I know that at least the Associated General Contractors has some opinions about how brilliant our proposal is. So we'll invite some public testimony and some critique of our ideas around PPPs at some point, so get yourselves ready for that. Labor might want to weigh in as well. They often express opinions about the subject. And so with that, why don't we hear a little bit about the Trunk Highway Fund bonding proposals that we have in our respective bills. We'll start on our side, Mr. Chair. We have the Corridors of Commerce and the Transportation Economic Development ideas. Council?
Mr. Chair, the what is Article 2 in both the House and the Senate sides begins on page R35, and on the Senate side there is the bonding appropriations on both sides are backed by trunk highway bonds. On the Senate side there is a total of $1 billion plus $1 million for bond sale expenses. $800 million is for Department of Transportation Corridors of Commerce, and this is available $200 million each year for 4 years from 2016 to 2019. There's also a provision that the commissioner may use up to 17% of the amount for program delivery.
And Ms. Berezovsky, as long as we're on that particular subject, the 17%, I remember there was some discussion about whether or not this allowed for right-of-way acquisition. Does that answer that question, or do we answer that question somewhere or somehow else?
Mr. Chair, I believe, but I would need to double-check this, that the Corridors of Commerce language provides for right-of-way acquisition within the program, but we don't specifically mention that, although the House does mention that on 24.30.
Okay. All right. Let's flag that as an item to discuss later.
Okay.
That's in the general appropriation.
Mr. Chair, then there's $200 million on the Senate side for Transportation Economic Development Program, and that would be available $50 million each year from 16 to 19 with the the up to 17% for program delivery language once again. And the House, I don't believe, provides for that 17% of program delivery. Then bond sale expenses and bond sale authorization, and that is our the Senate's trunk highway bonding program.
All right. Mr. Chair, why don't we hear from your counsel about the House trunk highway bonds?
Mr. Chair and members, on the House side, on page R36, there's also a Quarters of Commerce appropriation, is the largest of the House proposal for bonding. The total House bonding amount is, just backing up a step, $1.3 billion comparing to the $1.0 billion on the Senate side. And then similar to the Senate language, there's...
One moment. A quorum, Mr. President. Thank you. All right, go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, members, similar to the Senate language, there's $1.3 million for bond sale expenses. So both those in proportional terms are aligned between the House and Senate. It's just different amounts as a result of the different total appropriation levels. And so the House language for Quarters of Commerce is set up so that the appropriations are provided over a 7-year period compared to the Senate's 4-year range. And that's at $125 million per year for the first years from 2016 through 2021, and then it halves in the final year of the proposed program in 2022. And that's a similar approach for the other appropriations, where the amount is the same for the first 6 years and then is halved in the seventh year. The Quarters of Commerce appropriation language also includes a couple of project prioritization riders, and that's found on page R37 of the House language. There are a separate set of criteria that are established over and above what's part of the statutory criteria for the Quarters of Commerce program, and there are two separate sets, one for the MnDOT metropolitan district, and then the other is for districts outside of the MnDOT's metro area. One other thing about the Quarters of Commerce language that kind of goes back to a question on land acquisition is going back to page R13 as part of the state road construction appropriation on the House side. This is on R13, House language lines 8.16 to 8.19. There is authorization for MnDOT to expend amounts as necessary for the Quarters of Commerce program. So that's not a required spending, but it does authorize use of a portion of the state road construction appropriation towards land acquisition over and above the trunk highway bonding. So that would have the effect of giving some additional authority to MnDOT to split use of cash versus bonds in multi-staged or single-staged projects, really. So jumping back then to page R37, the Transportation Economic Development Program, appropriation starts at the bottom of that page, and the House has a total appropriation of $32.5 million, and this comes to $5 million per year until the last year and drops to $2.5 million. And then the largest, in comparison, remaining piece is a $455 million appropriation of bond proceeds. That's on page R38 on the House side, and that is for state road construction generally. So it's kind of similar to the SRC program cash, only this is through the bonding. That's at $70 million per year, and then in 2022, again, is half at $35
million. All right, is that it? Yeah, Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add that in the Senate language, there is a provision that comes a little bit later that provides that in the selection criteria for Corridors of Commerce projects, the commissioner should take into account the extent to which land has already been acquired. So just as a little bit more information as to your question about right-of-way acquisition.
So, I know it's not our bill, but
these so much. I don't remember everything. Was that to give priority to those projects that are already kind of stepping down the path?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if Senator Jensen wants to. It was actually part of her amendment. It was added to her amendment.
Right. Senator Jensen.
Yeah, it was discussion, Mr. Chair, that we had with Senator Kiffmeyer as well.
Right.
The exchange between, you know, make sure that we have taken into consideration people that, you know, districts that have already applied money to the land acquisition.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Representative
Earhart.
Does that skew anything in any particular direction?
In terms of project selection?
Yes.
I would assume the answer to that would be yes, that those corridors that have kind of started rolling and need to begin finishing their, you know, get you know, start finishing up the completion of those corridors, I think that's the idea.
I guess what I'm asking, Mr. Chairman, is does that mean that Highway 14 gets completed and nothing else gets done, for an example, or what?
Representative Earhart, no, I don't think, I mean, we, you know, both sides, we have, you know, on the order of $800 million for corridors. That's plenty to spread around. So, Senator
and
Jensen.
Mr. Chair, the sections on Highway 14 that are left don't have the land acquisition or the right-of-way purchased, which is the reason for making sure we have some cash for all projects across the state to make that land acquisition.
Mr. Chairman, we're not picking Highway 14, but that number always comes to mind when I think about highways. So.
Right. Well, it's kind of the inspiration for the idea of corridors of commerce was Highway 14. I'm sorry, Senator Jensen, did you have?
Well, just Mr. Chair, the land acquisition issue is all across the state because we have completed most of the projects that have the land acquisition completed already.
So along those lines, Mr. Chair, can your council help us understand some of these selection criteria for within the metro area and outside the metro area, kind of what the goals of that kind of priority looks like? Prioritization, wider language.
Sure. And I will let our staff do that. But just as a comment, Mr. Chair, and I think we're probably on the same wavelength here as well, is to make sure that the projects that are started are continued and the process continues. So I think that was our driving intent. But Mr. Burris,
Mr. Chair, and members, on the first section on page R37 at the top on the House side. The first writer gets at selection criteria for the MnDOT Metro District. And this would direct MnDOT to give priority first to projects that meet a couple of criteria. The first of those is has this cross-reference into Section 161.088, Subdivision 5, Paragraph B. That, in effect, directs MnDOT to use and to work off of the list of project recommendations that have been submitted by stakeholders through previous rounds of the Corridors of Commerce program. That list is published on MnDOT's website and is kind of a wide-ranging and somewhat far-reaching but a fairly defined set of possible project ideas. So MnDOT would be required to draw from that list first. The second of the requirements is to specify certain types of roads. It would be U.S. highways or other trunk highways that aren't part of the interstate system and have a higher traffic volume. So it's a annual average daily count of 50,000 or more vehicles. So it would be higher volume roads with that criteria or any of the U.S. highways in the metro. And the third component of the prioritization would be that the project would need to provide a form of capacity expansion. So the main vision or examples there would be auxiliary lanes or an additional general purpose lane being added on. The criteria then on project selection outside of the metro area is a somewhat different list. The first of the criteria here is that it would need to go towards projects that already have started in the Corridors of Commerce program. This is somewhat similar to the land acquisition provision found on the Senate side, but just has some kind of loose parallels and is a little bit broader in that it could be any project that had already gone into corridors of commerce for right-of-way acquisition, design, or environmental analysis. So projects that are had been funded for some of those stages. And again, there's a capacity expansion requirement. So it would be those corridors of commerce programs that would provide an additional lane of travel of some form.
Mr. Chairman, I'm asking a couple of questions. The last one series was that I am, without just listening to paragraphs rattled off, I'd like to see some kind of indication of the balance rural metro and geographically around the state as we read through the specs here, or when we get through, because I have heard several rumors that there was a lot of conniving to get certain areas taken care of, and I don't know if that's true or not. Without when you read this, or Mr. Burris reads it, it doesn't really register with me as where these things are landing. Is it possible that somebody can kind of summarize this before we, or are we going to vote on something today? So we don't.
Representative, I don't anticipate that we'll be voting on any of this, on any of these items today. We're just learning, but we can ask Ms. Hatch if she knows the kind of what has already happened with corridors of commerce, the relative rural-urban balance, and which of those corridors are kind of partially done. You know, are partially started with corridors program dollars, if that's all right. And you don't have to answer on the fly. You can get that to us later, unless you just have it in your head, which if you do, I'd be, like, really impressed. and then maybe also help us interpret what this language and also the language that the Senate brings would cause to happen in the corridors that might not otherwise happen if we didn't have language like that.
Mr. Hatch. Chair, for the record, my name is Tracy Hatch. I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Chief Financial, and Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Transportation. I would love to dazzle you with my knowledge about that, but I'm afraid I would be inaccurate in some instances. So we will be sure to get information back to both of the chairs as well as the entire committee with detail on all of those points.
Wonderful. Thank you. Any other questions on kind of what's in front of us in terms of the two different proposals? Of course, I'll just say for the record, Mr. Chair, in terms of the regular state road construction trunk highway bonding authorization, the Senate didn't necessarily leave out that function for any particular reason. So there's nothing to be inferred or read by this white blank here. We were just kind of focused on the TED and the corridors and then state road construction, you know, kind of cash, but we're not allergic or averse to doing bonding, some level of bonding, just the regular road construction program.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm flipping any cards to you prematurely. I just wanted to say that because I just didn't want people to get overly anxious or think that we're, like, leveraging something. We're not. It just didn't fall into our bill for whatever reason. Anything further, members? All right, why don't we hear from, and why don't we also invite Ms. Hansen up as well from MMB. And so I think they both know what we want to hear about. Why don't we first hear from Ms. Hatch about whatever you want to say about our trunk highway bonding program. We're always, of course, interested in the 20% threshold and why we did that and how we adhere to it and all of that. Ms. Hatch.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for inviting us here to talk about the trunk highway bond situation. You should have two pieces of paper. Actually, there is a third just for additional input, additional information. You should have one single page sheet. You should have a trunk highway forecast document. And then there should be a cardstock document, which is the financial snapshot. So we will start with the one-page white sheet. I just wanted to lay out here for you a little bit of where we started with the trunk highway policies, and in particular the bond policy. Minnesota Statute 167.60 actually required that we would develop a policy to manage our debt within the trunk highway fund, which is similar to the situation that the state is in with regard to MMB. That statute required that we developed the debt policy, and we developed three other policies along with that. If you're interested in a little just snapshot version of what each of those policies are, on the bottom of the snapshot document, on the front side of the snapshot document, it does list all four policies and where we lie in respect to each of those policies for each of the years in the forecast. So as a result of that requirement, we spent a few years, actually I think it was 2 years, that we spent writing the policy, vetting it with policymakers that were in place at the time, as well as the current governor, then Pawlenty, and our colleagues at MMB. And in the end, we decided that a reasonable yet accommodating yet prudent limit should be 20% of annual projected state revenues to the Trunk Highway Fund. And there's a couple of nuances in that. Keep in mind it does say state revenues, and the only reason I mention that is to be clear that it does not include federal revenue. It's not specific about what those revenue sources are. Doesn't matter if they are gas tax or some other tax or some other revenue that's deposited into the Trunk Highway Fund, but it would actually be state revenues to the Trunk Highway Fund. And so the debt service, the annual debt service payment, cannot exceed 20% of that amount that's of state revenue to the Trunk Highway Fund. I just want to point out real briefly, which is why I'm delighted that Kristen Hansen from MMB is sitting next to me, because it does have an impact. The trunk highway bonding does have an impact on the overall state policy guidelines for debt, and those are items that I would not be able to speak to. At the bottom of that chart, of that page, you'll see a chart. That chart is just merely there for example purposes, because we get asked this question a lot. What are current bond issues that are out for which we're paying debt service on? And this is essentially the list. The revised authorization column indicates the current bond issues that are authorized for MnDOT. The next column, total issued, think of that as the total bonds that have been sold to date. We only sell bonds when we actually need the cash on those projects, so we are very timely about when we issue these tax-exempt bonds, and only do so when the cash is needed. We do cash flows, quite robust cash flows on each bond-funded project, so we're able to estimate out what cash is going to be needed in the next 6 months or year on that project on a month-by-month basis. And then if we run short on the amount of bonds that we sell, the Trunk Highway Fund temporarily floats the bond payments until we're able to get to the next bond sale. The final column there, you'll say remaining authorization. That's the amount that is either remaining on current open bond authorizations or that has expired and canceled. The current open bond authorizations include the Chapter 152 bond authorization from 2008. And then the last three you'll note there, the 2012 Chapter 287, 2012 Special Session Chapter 1, and 2013 Chapter 117. We do expect that the bulk of that $736 million will be completely sold in the next two bond sales. Roughly, we're thinking about $350 and $350. It could go a little bit either way on that, but we expect to sell at least $700 million over the course of the next 2 years. So then turning to the actual forecast document, this larger document that you've been provided, if I could draw your attention to page 15. In the middle of page 15, there is a line graph there that represents the current forecast for debt service from the Trunk Highway Fund. As I'm sure you're all aware, the Trunk Highway Fund, according to the Constitution, must pay the debt on the Trunk Highway bonds. While Trunk Highway bonds are GO bonds, they're not a various purpose bond, they are a Trunk Highway bond, and therefore the Constitution requires that the Trunk Highway pay the debt service on the Trunk Highway bonds and not the general fund. And so, as you might imagine, we pay very close attention to what those bond sales are, what those bond cash flows are, and certainly to what those annual debt service payments are. And so you'll see there, the blue line represents the most recent forecast, which is February 2015. And we make this payment. It's due December 1st. We make it a little bit early just to be sure it clears the bank across the street. And this current year, fiscal year 2015, we made a debt payment of $154.6 million. And we're expecting to make a debt payment in 2016 of about $186 million. If I could draw your attention to the following page. The top of page 16, the chart there represents the current forecast in a little bit more specificity in terms of what our current debt service estimate is, the percentage that that is according to that 20% limit I mentioned earlier in the MnDOT policy, and then also what does that leave us in terms of capacity yet for bond issues. So on the top of page 16, that chart, you'll see that for 2015, our debt service payment, this is total debt service for the department, not just the trunk highway bonds. We have two other sources of debt in the department, and that is local government advances. When we advance a project or a local entity completes a project or a portion of a project, and then we reimburse that local entity for that expense, as well as we have a very small amount of a loan in the Transportation Revolving Loan Fund. So those payments are included in this number as well. So $164.1 million, which puts us at 13.3%, is our current estimated for this fiscal year percentage against that 20% limit. That seems like an awfully low number, and if you'll look from that point, that 13.3 number, straight up that column, you'll see that those numbers are really lovely numbers. They're in a nice range, a low range. When we first did those projections, we had factored in some premium on our bonds, and that premium came to fruition. So you'll notice those numbers are lower than the 15, 16, 17% that you'll see following, and that is a result of premium. We now are building premium into the actual debt service projections. So that fluctuation that has happened in the past where we expected it to be at, you know, 17% and we saved $50 million on premium on the debt and we ended up at, you know, 16 or 15%, we hope that that has smoothed out at this point. So sticking in that middle column, if you'll scroll your finger down a little bit, you'll see we hit 17% in 2017. That right now represents the peak for trunk highway debt projections. So at that point, we hit the high point, and we'll start going down. So what does that mean? That means that there is some capacity there, and every year subsequent, there is some additional capacity. In terms of, I'll give you a way to estimate, and then I'll give you some actual real hard numbers. If you look to the right column, you'll see that it says, the top of that column says variance from 20% policy limit. That variance represents the amount of debt service, so not the amount of total debt, but the amount of debt service that exists between the 17%, for example, in 2017, and hitting the 20% max. And so if you ever want just a real rough estimate, if you just multiply that by a factor of 10, you're very close in the ballpark. So according to this, we could take on, $380, $400 million pretty comfortably. And I suppose everyone is kind of curious where Minnesota lands in terms of the rest of the United States. And then what might I recommend or what might we say from a financial standpoint is the maximum that we could entertain in terms of additional debt at this time. Most states who take on debt for transportation purposes have debt in the range of 15 to 25% as their normal marker. Now, there are certainly outliers on either side of that. There are some states who have strict policies of absolutely taking on no debt for transportation. Here in Minnesota, we believe, and I would, from my expert opinion, would support the fact that debt is a really good and useful tool, and transportation is a perfect perfect use for debt. These are long-term assets. I do like the fact that Minnesota has been reasonable and prudent so far in the way that it has managed its debt, as opposed to some other states which are 100% leveraged. There are some states in the country that rely on every nickel of their state appropriations and every nickel of their federal appropriations to go completely to pay debt service. And I feel like given the volatility, particularly on the federal side, that puts us in a little bit of a dangerous place. So Minnesota right now lands about where the median is in terms of overall other states, as an example.
Two questions. One is, do we not count the state sources, the non-state sources, towards our 20% threshold because of that volatility factor? Just federal resources are so unreliable. Mm.
Mr. Chair, that is the largest part of that. They are volatile. We have absolutely no control over what the federal government does, as opposed to our ability on the state side to come back to the legislature and explain a situation and ask you to take action, either to help us or to modify something in the policy or an appropriation. We feel like the greater control lies on the state side, as well as we've seen a lot of volatility on the federal side. In fact, at about the time that this policy was being put together, the federal Highway Trust Fund actually did come very close to insolvency. That was sort of the first time. That's when the first federal general fund bailout of that fund occurred. And we actually were put, all states were put on sort of federal rationing for cash. So they had obligations out there that they would have been true for, but they were restricting payments to the state. So that was very much in play at the time that the policy was developed. That situation is currently very close to being in play as well, again, on the federal side due to federal revenue not being sufficient for the federal expenditures in the Highway Trust Fund. So that is the bulk of it. The other piece of it is that the federal funds that come in, 100% of the federal funds that come in go directly to paying for construction projects. We don't use any for overhead. We don't have any federal financial participation in any other way other than directly on projects. And so to change that would essentially open up that model substantially.
And then my second question is those states that have to use all of their incoming resources for debt service, mm-hmm. what do they do? I mean, do they just pay for past projects and just can't do anything? Or do they just continue to add to their, as stuff gets mm-hmm. retired, they just take on new debt and that's how they do new stuff?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's correct. And in fact, a couple of those states, and back in 2009 when we were putting this policy together and also were on the federal cash situation, many of those states were panic-stricken because they could not pay their debt holders if they did not receive their full reimbursement from FHWA. So, again, there, you know, there's two extremes, and then there's the middle.
All right. Oh, do you have anything further? Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just it'd be my understanding that you gave the number of $380 million approximately for capacity there. That would be with no new revenue, correct? If there was additional revenue, that capacity would be higher.
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct. And if I may, just that ties right into my final comment, which was I gave you kind of the rough, you know, kind of thumb sketch. We have ran some numbers, and of course we can play a little bit with the timing of when we would issue the bonds, the timing of when projects would be ready for letting, which projects we would put the bonds on, that type of activity. And when we do that, we can actually, we believe we can even go up so high as about $500 million in appropriated over the next two, preferably 3 years, would give us the greater flexibility to manage that. So we could do about $500 million in bonds without new revenue. Of course, new revenue of any variety that goes into the Trunk Highway Fund does give us a greater capacity as well. I'm sorry, if I could just make one last comment that I'm going to prime Kristen for it to think about for a second. Earlier you mentioned right-of-way. We typically do not buy right-of-way with bond proceeds because of federal arbitrage laws regarding tax-exempt bond issues. And so Ms. Hansen can speak more in detail to that. I just wanted you to have that knowledge.
Thank you. That's good to know. The 500 that you cite, how does that interact with the authorized but not yet sold debt, the 700?
Mr. Chair, we've already factored in the fact that we will sell the amounts that $736 million into that. So if we sell the 736, that's still available to us. There's a little bit of that that's already canceled, but the amount of that that's still available to us, if we sold that, we could take on $500 million on top of that.
On top of that.
We're expecting that we'll sell all those. We have projects underway and programmed and in various stages of development and delivery.
Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions for Ms. Hatch? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your this card on the bottom, it shows the forecast at 17%. I think we're talking on the debt service. I think it peaks at 17 on this, but you forecasting that same level amount for whatever reason. I guess why?
Mr. Chair, that is just simply rounding. We have two digits here. You'll notice on page 16 in the actual forecast document, we provide more details. So it's actually 16.9% in 2018 and 16.5% in 2019. And when I mentioned that we could take on about another $500 million, that would put us at a peak of 19.7% in 2019. Now, again, you know, if we delayed the letting of a project or kind of played with the schedule and the cash flows, we might be able to shift that slightly.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Barr,
this page then is based on the fact that you will not issue any more bonds except what you already have authorized. So it's going to be this until you get more debt service money.
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, the chart, both of those charts actually incorporate the fact that we plan to issue that additional debt. There are a complete projection at this point based on the cash flows on those projects, when we think we'll need the cash and then when we issue the debt.
That's the $736 million that you're talking about. I understand that. But that's already built in here. Yes. And so if you want to, that whole ball game changes if you get more debt service.
Representative Hart, yes. And then these percentages, like she said, just like the 17 that you see here, would go up to 19 point something.
Yeah.
If they were got no new revenue, but were authorized to issue up to $500 million more in debt. Questions?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you. So the chart that we're looking at here, the debt management policy with the forecasting, how does that interact with the 20-year plan? As far as the expenses and stuff.
Did everyone hear that?
Sorry, I'll speak up.
Yeah. So the question is, how does the
numbers that we're looking at on your debt management policy and the forecasting that you're doing interact with the 10-year plan or the 20-year plan?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, it's all completely kind of baked into the cake. So the numbers that we have in the 20-year plan are based on the knowledge that we have this debt authorized, that we will issue all of the debt, i.e. sell all of the debt, complete all of the projects for which the debt was issued and or programmed. And then the 10-year plan or the 20-year midship plan is beyond that.
Included. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Hatch? All right. Ms. Hanson. How are you feeling? You've had a rough couple of days. So, well, are you rallying? Are you here? Are you sacrificing to be here with us?
Chair, I'm here for you guys.
All right. Awesome. Those who don't know, she's been pretty ill for a couple of days. And
Chair, members of the committee,
I'm compelled to be here today. So we apologize if we dragged you in. But we thank you for being here.
So, Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kristen Hansen. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Debt Management at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I'm here to talk about the state's capital investment guidelines and how those work with general obligation trunk highway bonds and to kind of address what that, how they interact. And so I just have the one-page handout, but I'm also going to send over a copy of the debt capacity report. This actually gets released the same time as the forecast. It outlines what the three guidelines are and where we are in a point of time. But to give you an overview, the state currently has three capital investment guidelines. The first two relate to the amount of debt that's been authorized in comparison to the state's personal income, as well as the third guideline talks about the structure of the bonds and how quickly we pay off the principal. So our guideline one talks about the total tax-supported debt, and that means principal, not principal and interest, that's been outstanding or has been issued. So bonds that have been issued when we have our bond sales. That total amount of tax-supported debt can be no more than 3.25% of the state's personal income. Guideline two talks about the total amount of principal that's been authorized, that's been actually issued in bond sales, or that's been authorized and we haven't issued yet. And that number is not to exceed 6% of the state personal income. And then the last guideline, just like I indicated, indicates how quickly we pay off the state's GO debt, and that includes both the various purpose funds, those are the projects that are included in the bonding bills, as well as the GO trunk highway bonds. Those are also GO bonds, and that says that 40% of the general obligation debt will be paid off within 5 years, and that's kind of annual debt service, and 70% will be paid off within 10 years. And that's a very kind of conservative payoff. So those are the three guidelines that we operate in. They were updated in 2009 to correspond more with how the rating agencies actually look at our debt. And so, you know, the question becomes when we issue our debt capacity forecast, and we do this the same time as the economic forecasts get released, so we release those in February and November, and the personal income numbers that we use are the same numbers that the state economists are using in their forecast projections as well, so that we're consistent. And so, you know, oftentimes the questions come up both from the bonding bill side, as well as, you know, as you're debating kind of trunk highway debt, how do these factor into our guidelines? And so what we've done is taken a look at the impact of both the House proposal as well as the Senate proposal for the GO trunk highway bonds, as well as including the governor's bonding bill. And the only reason I'm including that is just because that's right now the only kind of bonding proposal that's out there, is that how would these impact the state's debt capacity guidelines one and two? And kind of some background to note is that if there is a bonding bill or GO trunk highway bonds passed, you know, we do not go out and sell all of those bonds all at once. For those of you in your local communities, when your cities or your counties or your school districts go out and issue bonds or pass building bond elections, they often sell most of those bonds all at once. The state does not do that, and as Ms. Hatch alluded to, is that we only sell bonds on a cash flow basis on the dollars that are needed. We're selling tax-exempt bonds, and we don't want to overissue the bonds. We don't want to pay more debt service than we have to. And there's also the IRS tax code. Because these are tax-exempt bonds, there's all sorts of rules and regulations that surround those, and we cannot earn money on borrowed money. And so there's reasons for the way we structure bonds and how many bonds we sell, but regardless of if there's a million-dollar bonding bill or a billion-dollar bonding bill, you know, we're not going to go out and issue those. We're only going to issue those on a cash flow needed for the next year until we bring bonds to market again for the state. And so currently both the House and Senate proposals have a trunk highway component to them, and they're different dollar amounts, but we work closely with MnDOT to find out, with these various proposals, how many bonds they're estimating that they're going to need kind of over the life of the potential authorization. And so right now, we've taken a look at that and kind of projecting forward to the November 2015 debt capacity report. Obviously, there'll be a change in the personal income. There'll be a change in the amount of bonds that we issue. We tend to have at least one bond issue post-session, two depending on market conditions and the cash flow needs for projects. And we'll also be paying off our existing debt, which affects our guidelines. But both proposals will fall within guidelines one and two, based on kind of the cash flow needs, as has been discussed between MMB and MnDOT. And so you can see the impact of the governor's bonding bill and both the Senate and House transportation bills. That guideline one will be at 3.08%, which is under the 3.25%. And guideline two, the Senate proposal would be 4.51% of that 6% of guideline two, and the House proposal would be 4.65% of the 6% for guideline two as well. So so as you're going along with your discussions, we just thought it would be it'd be helpful to know that both of the proposals, along with the governor's bonding bill, would keep us within the state's capital investment guidelines. And when we release the debt capacity report, it's just a snapshot in time. But as you can realize, with the change in personal income, the change in the amount of debt that's issued, change in the amount of debt that's been paid off, it's kind of a more fluid kind of projection. And so we're starting to kind of look forward to help you, the decision makers, make better decisions based on kind of more information.
Great, thank you. I just wanted to note, in case there's confusion, under the second and third black bullets, looking at the second bullets in each of those, the white bullets, if you will, when it says, I got confused when it said $800 million bonding bill. That refers to the governor's proposal, the GO bonding, because we have an $800 million proposal for Cortes of Commerce. So I got myself confused yesterday about that. Okay, great. And this additional information, that's just some various primer information, some facts about, I haven't looked at this yet.
Chair, I'd be happy to walk through those.
Why don't you do that, just so we understand what you're trying to communicate.
So the types of debt that are included in Guideline 1 and Guideline 2 are what's considered tax-supported debt, and that's how the rating agencies look at it. And so the type of debt that's included are the GO various purpose bonds, projects that are included in the bonding bill, the GO trunk highway bonds, as well as other what's called tax-supported debt, and that includes appropriation debt, so state-issued appropriation debt that the state has issued, but also there's some debt that's been issued by other entities that are also funded by a state appropriation, so the Housing Finance Agency, Housing Infrastructure Bonds, the University of Minnesota, the bonds that were sold for the stadium and the bioscience projects, those are supported by the state appropriation. So they're even though they've been issued by other entities, they're considered state debt because they're supported by the state's credit and the state's appropriation. Kind of the bullet point I had stated before is that bond authorizations are not all issued at once. They're issued on a cash flow need, so we don't overissue bonds and can stay in compliance with tax law. As I stated a couple times, the factors that do affect the guidelines are the state personal income, the actual dollar amount of the bonds issued, and the debt service payments on existing debt that are paying off our existing debt.
Great. Thank you. All right. Questions? Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back in the world of primer, could you just give a description of how the state personal income is calculated, when that's updated, that kind of thing?
Ms. Hansen.
Chair. Member. I would have to get that information from the state economist. We would be happy to get that information to you. They provide the information. I know they receive it from an entity that provides that information. We do get it updated. I do know they get it updated.
And just a quick follow-up. So it's essentially an aggregate of the personal income of all Minnesotans. Is that basically, in a nutshell, what we're talking about?
Sure. Remember, I suspect that would be the case, but I would like to give you a much more actual answer.
All right, you can convey that to Ms. Sabatka, and she'll distribute that to everyone. All right, other questions, members? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're talking about authorized on your one single sheet, but not appropriated, is that? And how does that factor in? When do you ask for the appropriation?
To Ms. Hansen or Ms. Hatch, or both?
This is MnDOT.
All right, Ms. Hatch.
Thank you.
Chair, Representative, the terminology there, authorized, is synonymous with the appropriation. So once it's appropriated by the legislature, we consider it that we are authorized, therefore, to sell bonds up to that amount and on that schedule as appropriated. So the words are synonymous in our world.
Thank you.
I might also say that the 500, if I may, Mr. Chair, the $500 million that I mentioned, while I speak for MnDOT, so MnDOT believes we can take that on in terms of our policy. I have not consulted with MMB yet on, in terms of the impact of that on the state guidelines. I suspect it probably will not be a hardship for the state, but I would defer that to MMB for their guidelines.
I do have
another question. Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, there was some, maybe the bonds for the stadium have already been let, because there was some time we were looking at how they were going to impact the GO bonding. Is that still pending, or have they been let and that's all factored in?
Ms. Hanson.
Chair, Representative, I assume you're talking about the Viking Stadium.
Excuse me? Yes.
The Viking Stadium. Those bonds were issued in January of 2014, so all of those bonds have been issued and they're factored into the guidelines.
Thank you.
All right. Anything further, members? Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of curious. Where are we at in the guidelines currently without looking at what we're talking about in these bills so I can get an idea of what the impact actually is to the percentage?
Ms. Hanson.
Chair, Senator, when we released the debt capacity forecast in February of 2015, at that point in time, the guideline one, which is the bonds that have already been issued, the tax-supported debt, we were sitting at 3%.
Okay.
And guideline two, which is the authorized issued and unissued, it was at 4.25%.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And we're within guideline three, the 40% to be paid off in 5 years, and 70% will be paid off within 10 years.
Chair, yes. When we bring our bonds to market, we structure the bonds to make sure that we're in compliance with guideline three.
Okay. Very good. Happy to hear that. All right, Chair Kelly.
Sure, and Senator Jensen kind of alluded to this, but we are talking about a point in time here. If we go out to 17, 18, 19, these are changing. Have you done projections on that?
Ms. Hanson.
Chair. yes, those numbers will change depending on how many, you know, bonds are authorized, how many bonds get issued over that period of time, how many of our bonds get paid off, as well as what the changing state personal income is. And we have a ginormous spreadsheet that has it on there, but we do those forward-looking projections.
Please forward that ginormous spreadsheet. I'm just kidding. We don't want it.
we're trying to make it more user-friendly.
So, I think, members, what was most interesting to me as I had to tackle this subject this year, for the first time, because the, you know, the level of trunk highway bond authorizations in our bill really became a subject of conversation, at least on the Senate side, was not so much that we were bringing resources to support the debt, but that the real key is the percentage of state personal income being. So it doesn't matter how much we bring in terms of resources to support the debt within the trunk highway fund. When we're talking about the overall debt picture, we really need to keep an eyeball on state personal income, both for the outstanding debt, the issued debt guideline number one, as well as issued and unissued, authorized but not yet issued, guideline number two. That was interesting. Anything further? All right. Well, conversations will continue. It's hard to really get down to brass tacks until we get our targets and can really start kind of winnowing through the money elements of our bill. But this has been informative. And so you are all well armed and informed to go back to our respective chambers to knock down any perceptions to the contrary that somehow what either of our proposals contain somehow will diminish our ability to do good, robust GO bonding capital investment bill. So MNSQ and the U of M will be just fine. That's what I'm trying to say, even if we do what we want to do here. So All right. what next? Senator Jensen, do you want to talk about your piece?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
All right. Should we have counsel kind of help us understand the...
That would be fine.
The proposal. And just by way of for preview members, Senator Jensen was our lead on this idea, brought it into the bill, was the chief author of the standalone bill that came into this proposal. And this is, of course, volunteer firefighters being treated somewhat on par with the professional firefighting service in the unfortunate circumstance that they might die in the line of duty and the benefits that they're... dependents enjoy, and I'll let Senator Jensen let us know after we hear from council kind of what the proposal is, but again, to preview, things have been worked out, and so we might be able to take some action on this. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair.
No, just present. Senate language. Okay.
Mr. Chair, the language in question begins on page R-117 at line 69.1, and it continues through R-118 and R-119 through Senate side line 70.26, and then there is also an identical provision on R-120, which is reporting firefighter deaths. It's 49.12 on the House side and 71.8 on the Senate side. So the basic idea, as Senator Dibble mentioned, of the language is to provide ongoing health insurance for dependents or survivors of a volunteer firefighter who dies in the line of duty. And this is done largely by way of amending an existing statute that provides for that type of benefit for career firefighters and officers. And it also provides for disability benefits for career firefighters and officers. The new language does not touch the disability area, but only the group health insurance benefits. So on the Senate language attempts to deal with various situations. One is when there is already group health coverage that would benefit a volunteer firefighter during the lifetime of the firefighter. And then the second situation is where the municipality does not cover a volunteer firefighter but covers other classes of employees. And then the third situation is when the municipality offers no coverage for any employees. So the way that the Senate language deals with those three situations is this. If there is coverage for the volunteer firefighter that's available during the lifetime, then it continues for dependents. And dependents are defined by reference to language that is in Chapter 62L, and that is a small business insurance chapter of law. The dependents are defined as the spouse, dependent child, up to age 26, except for a disabled dependent child who does not lose eligibility at age 26. And then there are some other possible categories of dependents as well under the operative definition. So the language inserts in all cases when coverage terminates. Coverage terminates when the spouse reaches age 65 or when the dependents either reach age 26 unless they fall into one of these other categories that keeps them on longer. So if there is insurance that covers a volunteer firefighter, it continues for the dependents after the death. If there is no coverage for the volunteer firefighter but coverage for other classes of employees, the municipality has to furnish coverage to the survivors that is equivalent or roughly equivalent to the average benefit provided for the insured employees. And then the third category being that the municipality does not provide group health coverage for any class of employee, and in that case, the dependents can buy their own coverage and the municipality will offer or must offer a minimum of 50% reimbursement to the survivors of the cost of the premiums. The Senate language has an effective date of January 1, 2016, and that would apply to deaths that occur after that date so that nobody is who is receiving benefits now would be impacted. Because actually the termination language is new, and this would apply to officers and career firefighters as well. So the benefit coverage would end at age 26. And then there's language also on the Senate side that provides that the employer is not prohibited from offering additional benefits or greater benefits than the minimum required in the statutory language.
And you said there was some language further back.
Mr. Chair, on R120, it's the next page of the side-by-side. There's a section that is identical on both sides, and that requires a fire chief to report any death of a firefighter and the circumstances of the death as well to the state fire marshal without undue delay.
Okay. Senator Jensen, if I'm not mistaken, the language of this on the Senate side is the product of more recent conversations mm-hmm. than. I mean, the House language was kind of an earlier version that you were a part of, but we were second to get out of the gate, and so this is a more recent, riper product of discussion
That's
with stakeholders.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct, that the House language happened first, and there were some concerns talked about by the League of Minnesota Cities, and we wanted to address their concerns. So we continued to work on the language, and when it was originally drafted, it was drafted to the language in what you see first, 299A.465 subdivision 2, and when we went through the committee process, we realized that the language and the underlying language that we were looking at wasn't working well either. So we went ahead and decided we wanted to change that language, get that fixed, as well as make sure that we had the concerns of the League of Minnesota Cities addressed in the section that involves the volunteer firefighters. And it was actually the line 69.18 that says that they would pay to is a dependent up to the age of 65. And when we were going through the committee, we're like, we're going to pay for benefits until the dependent is 65. It was very confusing language. And so this language fixes the underlying. It addresses the League of Minnesota Cities' concerns about those situations where what if they are not already offering a health insurance plan for their employees? What does the city do? And so that's why we decided to go ahead and lay out these are the things that would be available to those cities no matter what the circumstance was on what they were already offering for their employees at that time.
Great. And you've spoken with your counterpart working with in the House.
I have. And he has agreed that this is the appropriate
language. And that's Representative Hacker.
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Have you, Mr. Chair, have you been in communication with folks on your side?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have, and Representative Hackbarth does agree with this. The only thing I might add that our staff would be allowed to make some technical corrections with Senate staff. Other than that, that's all.
Okay, great. Questions, members of anyone about anything related to this subject? Would anyone like to address the committee on this subject? No. Okay. Senator Jensen, you want to make a motion?
Yes.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move that the sections...
Well, Ms. Berezovsky, can you help us articulate the motion?
Mr. Chair, the motion would encompass beginning page R117, line 69.1. The entirety of R18 on the Senate side, 69.11 to 70.7. And then on R119, 70.8 to 70.26. And finally, on R120, 71.8 to 71.12 on the Senate side.
With direction to staff that they are authorized to make technical and clarifying changes, amendments, whatever. All right. Questions on the motion, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Seventh provision has been adopted. Excellent. So, Mr. Chair, do you want to hear about public-private partnerships?
Yeah? I think we can move on.
All right. Very good.
Sure.
All right. So why don't we have another... this is kind of a lengthy piece. We'll ask our council to walk us through the public-private partnership section, but briskly. And then we'll have some conversation and take some testimony. I see AGC is here; they have opinions, and whomever else would like to illuminate us on PPPs, and we'll have a little discussion about what to do in future on future dates. Ms. Berezovsky. If it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Berezovsky is prepared to point out the differences between the two sides, unless you want your counsel to...
No, that's
all right. Very
we'll
good.
Add any comments if needed.
All right. Mr. Burris, just dive right in if Ms. Berezovsky's got it all wrong. All right. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and members, the language begins on R132, and it is section 63 on the House side and section 26 on the Senate side. And it is one lengthy section, I believe, that goes on for a few pages. So the bills are really quite similar in most ways, and they set up a pilot program that would allow the Met Council or MnDOT to choose up to three projects in which to utilize a public-private partnership procurement method. And the language is quite detailed as to the types of projects that would be eligible, the scrutiny that candidate projects would go through, the necessity for consultation, both with government authorities and also with a consultant of some type. There are lengthy sections or subdivisions having to do with required subject matter of the public-private agreement and also permissive or permitted subjects that the agreement may deal with. There is it's contemplated that other uses or other sources of funds could be brought into these agreements, whether from the federal government or other government units, and there are reporting requirements. So those are the general subject areas that this section deals with. Some of the differences are in the nature of the project, and if you want page and line, let me know. I've noted those. Both sides agree that it must be new projects, and they cannot involve existing infrastructure unless they add capacity to the system. The House specifies that the project must be of a capital nature, and it must exclude rolling stock, and that that restriction is not, or limitation is not, on the Senate side. The House limits eligibility to a project with a cost estimate that does not exceed $100 million. And the Senate has no limit in its language. There's some difference as to the expectation that the piece of infrastructure may actually be conveyed to the private partner. And on the House side, a temporary transfer of ownership of the infrastructure is contemplated as long as the contract requires return by a specific date within 25 years. And the Senate does not restrict the transfer of ownership, except that there must be a specified date of return in the contract. The financing methods are a bit different. The House, there are acceptable mechanisms, and I had to look them out, a lot of them up, because I didn't know what they were. So I do have some definitions, though, if anybody is wondering what some of these are. I do have definitions available. But so that both the House and the Senate agree that acceptable mechanisms include user fees, construction payments, joint development agreements, negotiated exactions, and air rights development. And the House provides that these are the only mechanisms that can be used to finance these agreements. The Senate does not have a limitation as to the type of mechanism that can be used, but it does state that acceptable mechanisms are those that the House lists, and also toll facilities, BOT and BTO facilities, and these come out of state statute, actually, and they have to do with toll facilities. And BOT is build, operate, transfer, and BTO is build, transfer, operate.
Can you point to chapter, line, and?
Yes. Well, those are referred to on the Senate side at line 93.22. That is the section that I'm referring to on the Senate side. 93.26 specifically refers to BOT and BTO.
Right.
And Senate side also mentions street improvement districts and tax increment financing for transit projects. So and then in terms of consultation, the House specifies that MnDOT and the Council must consult with specified commissioners and transportation groups. On the Senate side, the MnDOT and the Council are required to form an advisory and oversight office, and that consists of basically the same parties that the House refers to, but also CTIB is brought in on the Senate side. The Senate requires this office to work with representatives of MnDOT workers and to review proposed contracts and determine whether the contract serves the public interest. Then both the House and Senate require additional consultation with experts in public-private partnership evaluation and contract scrutiny. Then, as far as the selection of the private entity with whom the state would contract and project selection, the criteria are mostly the same in those areas. As far as the agreement goes, as I mentioned before, there are required provisions in the ultimate contract between the state agency and the private entity. There are required provisions and there are permitted provisions. Among the required provisions, they're identical with technical differences, except that the Senate also requires in the contract a specification that would concern the extent and nature of involvement of public employees. And the permitted provisions are identical with only technical differences. The funding, as I mentioned, both sides contemplate utilizing federal funds to support these projects and also to their both houses direct the MnDOT and the council to maximize project funding from non-state sources. Both require annual reporting to the legislature, and the House ends both the reporting requirement and the ability to enter into a new agreement in 2019, and the Senate does not have an end date in its language.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Burris, anything to add? Nope. Okay. Very good. Questions, members? All right. Would anyone like... Senator Schmidt.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question of clarification. There's a reference in Subdivision 1 on a limitation of three projects for Met Council and the department. Is that a total of three or three each? If you could just clarify that.
Ms. Berzowski.
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, it's a total of three.
Okay.
So like two at MnDOT and one at Met Council or vice versa?
Mr. Chair, it could be that or it could be a collaboration.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, thank you. I don't know if MnDOT wanted to, or if anyone wanted to testify. First of all, invite MnDOT forward to see if they had any commentary or reaction. Welcome, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Peterson from MnDOT.
I know this is not a MnDOT initiative, so we're not asking if you support this or not. But you can if you want. We invite you to support it enthusiastically and wholeheartedly and make it a huge priority.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in general, the department is supportive of exploring the opportunities that public-private partnerships provide for bringing other non-traditional sources of revenue to invest in transportation projects. And the language in both bills provides a fair amount of structure for future agreements, and we think it's compatible with, in general, again, in the thoughts that we've had about how we would proceed under this. There are a couple of things, in particular, in the Senate bill language that we think are more conducive to concluding some P3 agreements. I should say one is the absence of the language, and that is the limit of $100 million on a project that can be put under a P3. We think that the amount of overhead that's involved in kind of going through the RFP and negotiating these agreements and creating the governance structure and all the terms and stuff is probably disproportionate to the amount of value that the public could receive from a $100 million project investment. So we think that, you know, all things considered, that's probably lower than what's feasible in this, in the type of agreement that's envisioned in this language. And then on the Senate side, it leaves in the ability to toll, which I think is probably a very important part of any future potential for a P3 agreement, that is the ability to provide toll revenue. Any agreement will need a revenue source of some kind in order to make it work. The private entities get in this to make money. And so if there's not another substantial revenue stream for these, then it would just require us to use some of our existing revenue streams to support the payments that would be required under these agreements. And because of the way Minnesota is structured with our constitutionally dedicated funds and our relatively low-cost borrowing, you know, doing it the more traditional way with our existing revenue to finance projects is probably, you know, highly competitive with other terms that a private proposer could bring to the table.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Mr. Peters. Great. Thank you. I would invite anyone else forward who would like to testify on this proposal. Mr. Werke, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. I'll try to be brief, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate the opportunity and the indulgence of the committee on this important matter. I believe you have in your possession a copy of a letter that we recently drafted to the conferees about this provision. If not, I believe there's some copies up here. And I apologize, I'm not an expert on finance, I'm not an expert on P3, but we have put an awful lot of thought into public-private partnerships within our organization, and we think this is something that deserves a lot of attention and a lot of focus if it's going to proceed as a matter of public policy. Attached to our letter, you'll see a P3 white paper that I had a brief opportunity to present in both bodies that outlines some broad principles that we think are necessary for a successful P3 launch in Minnesota. I need to also state up front that as an organization, we are not necessarily opposed to public-private partnerships. We think they have a place, and we think that P3s are marching towards reality in this market, which is why we have spent time thinking about this as an organization. But what we do want to see is a thoughtful approach that brings together the best of what we see around the country and tries to eliminate some of the pitfalls that other areas may have stepped into. So that's simply because P3s are perhaps the most sophisticated and complex forms of alternate procurement that are out there, and can leave a host of problems in their wake if they are not structured correctly. We think the language in both bills has some deficiencies. I think, as most aptly listed in the last paragraph on the first page of our letter, and I won't specifically address those. I'll let you take a look at them unless you have a question about them. We're also concerned about the opportunity for public input on this. It's a major change in policy in the way procurements are handled in Minnesota. We think there needs to be a thorough discussion and vetting of that. We have done that within our organization, which, if I can remind you, we are an organization of vertical contractors and horizontal transportation contractors. A number of our members have experience doing P3 work in this country and in Canada, and we drew upon their best and brightest and had a working group that we assembled to put that white paper together. Have reviewed the language in both bills, as we continue to read the language, we do have concerns with it. We have taken the language and worked through it and made some significant amendments to it, but I'm not sure that this group is interested at this time in looking at a wholesale rewrite of both sections of the P3 language. Lastly, I would say a couple of items. Language and prescriptive language gives our members comfort. We look to see that criterion and objectivity and subjectiveness are removed as much as possible. It does not give us comfort to cede administrative authority to governing bodies to sit down and determine what the conditions and the rules of major programs spending major millions of dollars look like without significant public input. And so I'd lean to tell you that the more language and the more prescription we would see, the more comfort we would have. And then lastly, as Mr. Peterson indicated, some specific concerns, the lack of what are referred to as availability payments, especially in the House bill with the removal of the ability to provide toll revenues. I don't think you're going to see very many joint ventures come into the market with this authorization ready to propose, given sort of the unstructured nature of both of these attempts at P3. I would encourage you to take a look at it. Again, we would offer our commitment to work very hard to try to bring a product to you that would be representative of an inclusive approach. I think we have done that. Our history shows that we have been engaged on the forefront of things like design build and construction manager at risk and construction manager general contractor and those types of procurement options, and would do so as well on this. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll leave my comments stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Werke. Questions, members? Representative Earhart.
Representative Kelly, were you going to...
No, go ahead.
Well, I remember when we heard this bill in the House, maybe the House part, I don't know, but there was a lawyer that specialized in this and worked a lot of cases, and he recommended, I think it was two or three states that were far had language far superior to what was being exhibited. Now, I haven't spent any more time on that, and I did mention that to Mr. Peterson at the time. Why are we going to do a bill that is not up to snuff when we have an attorney testifying that you are lacking here? And this is kind of sketchy, but I don't know, in a conference committee, if you rewrite the language you have here or what. And I don't know even who that attorney was. Somebody brought him in, and one of the organizations, maybe Mr. Werke's organization.
Was it Jay Lindgren from Fagery and Benson? Or, Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, my recollection in Representative Earhart, it may have been the individual that I was hoping could be here today who is unable to, is an individual named Mark Becker, who is an attorney with the Fabianski Law Firm in Minneapolis. Mark Becker is both a civil engineer and a litigator attorney, and has vast experience in P3 and understanding of it, and he was the lead of our organization's multidisciplinary working group on P3, and he was the one, I believe, Representative Earhart, who indicated that other states have model legislation that we were hoping to pattern some of this language after.
So, Mr. Chairman, with that said, what do? We take what we have here and decide that this is good or bad and pass it, or do we pause and look at something else, or how do we work this?
Well, it remains to be seen.
I mean, I don't know how much you rewrite stuff when you get this far along.
Well, I'll just say that this language has been around for at least 4 years. So we're in the fourth year of language almost identical to what's in front of us, having moved through the process. The Department of Transportation also had a public-private partnerships working group that met and worked, and this reflects a lot of that work as well. This also reflects a lot of work that comes out of the National Conference of State Legislatures. So this is not sketchy, by the way. I don't think we should use words like that. This is actually the product of some hard work. And I'll just say, Mr. Werke, I think some of the language of your letter is a little bit strong and not accurate. Words like not well-crafted, not had the benefit of broad public testimony and discussion, unworkable, not viable. I don't think any of those statements are actually true. And I actually think we can get to something better than we have now. I think we actually have a pretty good start on what is actually accepted to be and widely recognized to be some of the best practices from around the country that avoids specifically some of the mistakes that we've seen in places like Indiana, Texas, and Illinois. So I think we actually have a proposal that we could work out and actually get in pass into law. And I have some ideas about how we might craft that so that we get to some of the elements that Mr. Werke articulates that are good. I actually appreciate some of the critique you find in the last paragraph, as well as some of the critiques and some of the ideas in the white paper, though I will say some of the elements in the white paper are in the proposal, mm-hmm. so the white paper itself isn't completely accurate either. And we could get something done this year that's pretty good. Chair Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Work, I do have a
no problem.
I do have a question. In one of your statements, you say the critical elements, you know, the policy are lacking. But where in the, either the House or the Senate language would it suggest that we would not get fair and open competition?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think some of the things end up getting down into the detail as these programs often do, and in terms of what is objective and what is not. Let me illustrate, for example, there are no criterion listed in terms of rating and scoring what elements of a proposer's proposal would be deemed advantageous over another proposer's provisions. What are those specific elements that are going to be scored? How do you score them? How do you ascribe value to them? And how do you bring about objectivity and fairness to them? These things may seem trivial and may seem less than important in a broad authorizing piece of legislation. We have found out in our organization, however, in practice, they become very meaningful when scores and selection are determined on something other than price, and someone is making that decision, and someone is deciding, I like this proposal better than that proposal. There are other deficiencies like stipends, a lack of a stipend. I don't think you're going to get someone to invest perhaps millions of dollars to develop a proposal only to find out that they were unsuccessful in that pursuance of that proposal. Other major alternate procurements in law provide for the owner to issue stipends to unsuccessful proposers. There are things like proprietary approaches, means and methods, and other things that come into play in terms of whether or not you make a decision to pursue a project. So I understand it's an authorization, it's a broad allocation of authority to move into this realm, but those kinds of things are things that, if not addressed openly and objectively, get litigated. And they have been litigated in the past in this market and caused project delays, cost to taxpayers, and other various things that are distasteful.
So, Mr. Warkey, this is these are good comments, which I appreciate very much, and I think they also reflect the concerns that members of your organization brought forward around the some of the best value selections that have been made, which we're trying to improve through some objectivity of selection and establishing those criteria. I'll just say that these are not insurmountable technical issues. We already have, of course, established in the proposal an independent advisory and oversight office, which consists of a number of members independent of the implementing agencies. That section can be strengthened with some of the ideas you've articulated. We have evaluation and selection of private entity and project, in which the commissioner and the council are directed to contract with independent experts to assist in the evaluation and selection, and a number of criteria that's set forth. Again, in the criteria, we can strengthen that process and who those folks are, and add to some of the criteria by which projects are selected. Some of the items that you articulate. So again, I think, you know, these are not insurmountable critiques that we can work out in a matter of the time we have remaining. Other questions, members? If Would anyone else like to testify on this? Mr. Carney.
Hi, Bob again, Carney Jr. I'm a registered lobbyist for We the People and Informal Association. A couple points on this. The first and the biggest one is this doesn't belong in an omnibus bill. This is not related to the budget. It's something that can be allowed to go into a future session. This is just not right. That's the first point. Second, I'm very concerned about turning this kind of authority over to the Met Council. I just have to be very blunt about that. Don't have confidence in them. This is like hamburger helper for capital projects for the Met Council. Seems like a very bad idea in that regard. Mm-hmm. Let me just make a couple quick points about specific elements that, to consider. In terms of the Senate provision for no rolling stock and the allowing it, you might want to consider a prohibition on rail and allowing buses. Just one thought. The House, basically, I think, is right on those positions. There should be a maximum of 25 years. There should be limited mechanisms triggering the use of this. And the sunset in 3 years is absolutely crucial. But in conclusion, this is not right. It does not belong in an omnibus bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Carney. Questions, member? So, Mr. Chair, here's an idea I have.
Just one with, if Mr. Reed could maybe make a clarifying sure. comment about general obligation bonds, P3.
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and members, just to point out that Article 11, Section 5 of the Minnesota Constitution, public debt and works of internal improvement in terms of general obligation bonds, have a prohibition of turning geo-bond-funded projects over to a private entity without the kind of full value being paid back to the state. So if a public-private partnership were to be entered in where the private entity takes ownership of a project, mm-hmm. it would have to not be geo-bond-funded.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do either of our provisions provide for that, or would we need to change something?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's not so much about what the language would provide for. It's just that the funding stream can't be GO bonds.
Okay.
So,
great. Thank you. So, my sense is, and tell me if I'm wrong, that we both sides have an interest in this idea. There are some differences in our proposals. There's some critiques that I think are good and valid, but not insurmountable. An idea that I have would be to do two things. One is see if we can't work or see if anyone has any special energy around this on either side. I do, actually, so I would be willing to invest some time in my spare time because I have so much of it. In trying to fashion a proposal to bring back to the conference committee, that incorporates the best of both sides, incorporates some of these critiques and anything else that anyone else would want to bring forward, and maybe depending on how close we can get, we can also maybe some of these elements, particularly that the AGC articulates, can't be buttoned up either in language or in time by some sort of an aggressive effective date. So we could direct that these elements be worked out by MnDOT through some process, or by MnDOT, Met Council, and whomever through some process, do a delayed effective date for a pilot project to commence pending the favorable outcome of dealing with some of these. Some of these elements. That's a just a blue sky brainstorm idea. What do you think of that?
Well, Mr. Chair, in respect for all the work that has been done over the last several years, I think just having language in both bodies would attest to the fact that there is interest here, and I would suggest that'd be a logical way forward. And I would suggest that the AGC take note of that and help with the process. And I'm sure it will be welcome, along with the department as well. And I think that would be a wise move.
So, Mr. Chair, what I'll do is I'll try to work proactively over the next maybe over the weekend, over the next few days, to bring some folks together, have some productive conversations. Anyone on your side who's in terms of conference committee members who's interested, let me know. We'll get together and bring back a proposal.
questions from our members?
Oh, and I'll just say for the record, this work has actually been done jointly by a partnership between myself and our lead Republican, Senator Peterson, and it is actually his bill, and I had a hand in making amendments and helping craft it. So it's really a joint project, bipartisan, of our committee over the period of the last few cycles.
All right.
All right. That concludes our three items. Mr. Chair, any closing words?
Not at this point.
All right. And the gavel will revert to you. I'll let you just hang on to it until you decide to meet up, call us together again. I know that you have some personal matters to tend to tomorrow, so I won't hold you to calling us in tomorrow. And
that
not crazy about coming in on Sunday, but
I think that'll be safe. Well, there will be no meetings over the weekend.
So likely we'll meet next Monday, and you'll have the gavel on Monday, and you and I will talk about what we're going to be able to cover in our next get together.
Sounds great.
All right. Anything further, members?
Great.
Nope. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.